Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen episode 118, Migrant Midwest. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Our guest today is Jonathan Mann Burkham. He is a professor at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and the author of this book. Thank you very much for joining us, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Excellent to have you. Well, as we may have told you in the briefing papers, Greg and I are both Illinoisans, and so we are always happy to see the Midwest get its fair due. I guess my first question about this book was, you know, what inspired you to write it? The timing was extremely adept, probably more than you even intended when you started off. Several things have transpired in the upper Midwest since you wrote this book.
Yeah, I think really the impetus for writing the book was, I felt like there was this kind of disconnect between the public conversation around immigration and then these demographic trends that were happening to a certain degree across the country, but particularly here in the Midwest. Just the fact that our population is, stabilizing and kind of headed for a kind of decline. And, you know, on the one hand, that's happening. And then on the other hand, right, you're seeing in the news, right, these claims that we're suffering from an immigration invasion and, you know, some people kind of making these claims that the country's full, we can't take any more people. And it just, these two things just didn't add up to me. So that's when I kind of sat down and said, you know, I want to write a book about this.
Well, let's start. Can you give us like an overview of the Midwest? Again, you know, proud Midwesterners here. When I think of like migrants to the Midwest, you think of those waves of the Swedes and the Germans into Minnesota and elsewhere. Obviously, the Indigenous peoples and the First Nations were there first. And you think about, of course, the Great Migration of African Americans to places like Chicago. What is your sweep here in terms of like how we should think about migration historically to the Midwest before we get into the current challenge?
Yeah, no, that was great. You covered a lot of it. right. So it really was, in my book, I kind of break it down into these different periods, more or less 60-year periods. The first being kind of this settlement wave, where people are coming from out east, right? People from England, traditionally, historically from England, Ireland, Scandinavians, right? And then in particular, Germans somewhat later on. Right. And so they're kind of settling the Midwest. And what I'm finding, or what I found in my research, is that, you know, from the beginning, there was kind of this demand for supplemental labor, right? And we kind of tell ourselves this story of these settlers that came and they set up these family farms and they had these really large families that was kind of like driving those family farms. And that's true to a certain degree, right? I mean, fertility rates at the time where on average women had 7 kids. So they did have these really large families, but even then there wasn't enough labor. So you had kind of migrant workers coming, itinerant workers coming and supplementing that work done by those farmers, right? And then you enter this period of the emerging, what I call the kind of multicultural industrial heartland, where the big cities of the Midwest, particularly along the Southern Great Lakes, start to kind of flourish. And this is a period of, mass European immigration, right? And then that all comes to a close in the early 1920s as the nation kind of shuts its door on new immigrant groups. You know, there's a lot of concern about among certain people about immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe in particular, Catholics and Jews, frankly. And so the nation's immigration laws really change, restricting immigration. And then following that, right, we have kind of the Great Migration from the South to many northern cities. And then that, going back to fertility rates, right, after having a period of major decline in the fertility rates from, the early 1800s, like I said, about 7 children per woman, it drops down to close to what we call replacement rate, which is 2.1 children per woman, so about 2 kids per woman. So it's getting close to that. And then you have the baby boom, right? And the baby boom really picks population back up, and that kind of creates this population momentum where the region, the Midwest, continues to grow largely from what we call natural increase, right? Births exceeding deaths. But then, you know, ultimately I get to the point in my book, about halfway through the book, where I'm saying, well, we're now entering this period that I call demographic winter, which is, you know, population stagnation and kind of decline and, you know, all the challenges that poses for the region.
So when did that start, and what would you ascribe the causes? Because right, I was about to ask, like, you know, the Rust Belt, as we think of it. And, you know, Ed Glaser at Harvard has noted, I think, like, the number one variable for population increase in the United States or any given city in the post-war era is the median temperature in January. So the snowbirds start leaving, yeah, and industrialization goes to the south. Like, can you put a date on that one? When do we think of, like, the modern Midwest as a region of decline?
I mean, there were signs early on, you know, even before the Second World War. You know, obviously the Great Depression was hit the Midwest particularly hard. But you know, coming out of the war, you know, we're still growing because of the Great Migration, the baby boom. But I'd say in the 1960s, certainly by the late 1960s, 1970s, is when you really start to see that migration from the Midwest to the Sun Belt. You know, and there's different explanations for what was driving that. You know, I think weather gets climate, right, gets a lot of the you know, kind of colors our popular understanding of this, but I think a lot of this was about kind of the decentralization of industries that were located, again, kind of in the industrial heartland. And they were moving south. I mean, they're moving south for cheaper land, cheaper labor, to get away from labor unions. And so I think that was, seems to be the real kind of initial impetus for, you know, the population moving to the South. A lot of the industry, was moving to the South. And then, you know, from what I've read, it seems to be that housing cost, you know, would then be kind of like the next real driver of that migration to the South. So it was just, you know, that cheap land, you know, lack of building codes, you know, that are contributing to this build out of affordable homes. And so I think those were the big drivers starting, yeah, late 1960s, 1970s.
Great. All right. And then completing the arc then, how would you describe sort of the current migration patterns of the Midwest? Because again, being Illinoisians, and it's funny, I was just in Ohio, so seeing through their prism was interesting. But as Illinoisians, right, like here's a state that is in, like, basically, as far as I understand it, demographic collapse, right? A downward spiral where you see population outflows to low tax, like southern states. So the increase on taxes to basically make up for services. And yeah, and basically, you know, Illinois seems to be circling the drain here when it comes to net population loss. Is that true elsewhere? Like, what is the state of play here in terms of thinking how we make the Great Lakes great again?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the case in so many cities. I mean, I know, I don't think, you know, Milwaukee's in as dire maybe a financial situation as Chicago. I mean, I was just looking at Chicago and I saw, you know, an estimate that about 40% of the city's budget are going to kind of legacy costs, you know, pensions largely, right, and debt. In, you know, in Milwaukee, we feel it. That's where I live. And, you know, we see it just in our schools, right? I mean, declining school enrollment. And so we're always looking at, you know, which schools are going to be cutting, you know, which jobs are we going to be cutting from the school district. Other communities are seeing this. I mean, to stay on the topic of schools, right, you're seeing a lot of, I know throughout the state of Wisconsin, a lot of school referendums, because the state has imposed kind of property tax limits for schools on the school levy. And so you're seeing all these referendums happening, you know, people voluntarily voting to increase their taxes, and some not. Some places are kind of pushing back on that now. So for schools, that's a particular challenge. You know, public transportation, you know, in cities, you know, are coming up on funding shortfalls, right? So there are so many of these fiscal challenges. I detail also in the book a lot of the employment challenges, and maybe we could get into that. But, you know, the fiscal challenges, I think, are really difficult for, you know, many cities throughout the Midwest. Now, there are some cities that have done fairly well, Madison, Wisconsin, right? You know, Columbus, Ohio. You know, there are a few shining stars.
Minneapolis, if you are a state capital with a flagship public school university system in it, you are gaining population. Yeah. And there's like three of them.
That seems to be the case.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting that you mentioned Minneapolis, because that I recently came from there. As I was relaying earlier in the before we started the recording, I was actually watching a traveling concert show, but happened to be in Minneapolis. The opening act for this show was the comedian Bobcat Goldthwait, who, again, I was saying to earlier, I thought was dead. I didn't realize he was still in business. He's very much alive. And he noted, as, and that certainly went with my observation, like, hey, you know, I know what they say about Minnesota nice, but you guys have been really good at Minnesota F ice. And, you know, that's such an interesting nexus, because it is so prevalent. If you go around there, I mean, maybe my sample size was somewhat limited in that I ended up in a lot of bookstores because of who I was traveling with, but, boy, they are really adamant. I mean, they were really protective of their Somali population specifically, but also just the general idea of, like, the federal government can't come in and start, you know, terrorizing people like this. And they came out, you know, and defended that community in the bitter, bitter cold, et cetera. So that seems like a place where I don't know that assimilation is the right word. And we should get into that definition in a minute, because that is something that you do dwell on in the book. But that seems like a place where there is enough economic momentum that whatever immigrant influx they've had has not been considered negative. And that may not be the only governing factor. But I'm wondering if there are places where you see that dynamic working better or worse, you know, in areas of the Midwest, where you see contemporary conditions such that they're absorbing migrants well, and what makes the difference?
Yeah, you know, I always feel like this is such it's a great question. It's a difficult one to answer, I feel like, without being on the ground, I guess, in a lot of these communities. You know, from my perspective, right, you see it often, mayors, for example, you know, they recognize that their communities are dealing with, you know, these population challenges, population decline in some places, you know, a shrinking labor force in many places. And so they are actively often trying to recruit immigrants as a way of, you know, bolstering their labor force and their population. And so, you know, I assume many mayors have a pretty good sense of, you know, kind of the limits of what their communities will accept. But I just feel like with the issue of immigration, it gets nationalized, right? And it becomes this really polarizing force. So I'm left wondering often, you know, to what degree is this kind of like grassroots kind of outrage against immigrants, just say, you know, Springfield, Ohio, for example, right? Sure, there were some reports about the large, you know, recently arrived Haitian population there. But, you know, all the reporting I've seen from Springfield, Ohio seems to suggest that, you know, the community was really kind of accepting of this population, recognizing that this was an important population of families, right, that were necessary for the city, right? But then once the, you know, the national media got a hold of this narrative of, you know, what was happening there, and you just see it this becoming this really kind of polarizing force, you know. And I look again, like, look at the city of Milwaukee. I mean, our population here has been in decline. You know, I think the city of Milwaukee at its peak was maybe 700,000 people in the late 1960s. You know, we're down well below 600,000 now. And without a growing Hispanic population, particularly in the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, you know, we would have just bottomed out. We would have lost another 50, 60, 70, 80,000 people from the city. And so certainly here, I don't get a sense that there's any real, you know, resistance to this population, you know, much pushback, because I think, again, there's just kind of a recognition that, you know, that this is needed for our city to stabilize. And you know, I think so much about this kind of narrative of the, you know, the United States as a nation of immigrants. And I think it's really important, because I do think many Americans, even those that are maybe somewhat skeptical and hesitant with immigration, they I think they accept that narrative. Most, you know, there's a sliver of the population that doesn't, but I think most accept that narrative. And so even when they may feel like, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with this change, they at least know enough of the history to know that, you know, our history is as an immigrant nation.
I'm also wanted to center on something else in your book that was quite interesting. You make an argument that you preface as potentially being somewhat controversial, which is that it's the idea of what is assimilation. First of all, you try to sort of get around of what that concept is, and then secondly, is it a good thing that people tend to, when at least when they first arrive, show up in ethnic enclaves, and then if they stay there for multiple generations, is that A, a good thing? Is that B, assimilation, and or is it something else? And what should we be encouraging, I guess, is the real question. Because obviously, you know, just talking to like one of our previous interviewees who did a book about gentrification, you know, these neighborhoods become strongholds of identity that are very important to those communities and overall in some cases, to the marketing of the city itself as a desirable place to be, to visit, to come live in, you know, and then when these ethnic neighborhoods are threatened by gentrification, all of a sudden we realize we had something that we could lose. So I guess I want to be clear about what is your suggestion about the desired path for immigrants so that they can best flourish in contemporary American society? I guess that's a short way of putting it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, assimilation. So, you know, this term assimilation, I would say it has become, I guess, somewhat controversial within academia and maybe on the political left somewhat because, you know, it's kind of, there's this implication that means, you know, that people are going to come and give up aspects of their culture to, again, kind of assimilate into the mainstream culture. And so I wade into this a little bit because I think that, you know, at least some definition, which I'll share in a moment, is an important, some definition of assimilation is an important kind of component to building a stronger nation, some level of assimilation. And I see that as, you know, on the one hand, people are going to come in and I think, you know, they're going to often land in immigrant enclaves. And I think that's going to continue to happen. But then the question, I think, becomes to what degree, right, are they going to, that population going to kind of interact with other members of the mainstream population, right? And I think ultimately that it may be good to have more of that interaction. And I often see it as, and when I think of assimilation, I think of it as, you know, you really have to look at that kind of second generation of the population, right? Not the original people that arrive, but often their children, to see whether their children are a couple of things. One, assimilating or really integrating socioeconomically. Are they seeing socioeconomic kind of gains, right? Because some immigrant enclaves can be challenging environments for kind of socioeconomic integration and kind of upward mobility. Okay. The literature is really mixed on this. You know, some immigrant enclaves can launch people into, you know, higher socioeconomic status, and others, right, can kind of hold people back, right? And I'm not saying that's based on any particular nationality or anything, but, you know, I think we do have to be aware that some of those immigrant enclaves are often in inner cities, right, that have issues of poverty, issues of crime, and maybe, you know, school districts that are not the best, right? And that can be a challenging environment for a lot of those kids to grow up in, right? And so I'm really interested in looking at kind of how that second generation maybe then not only shows, you know, greater higher educational attainment, you know, does better economically maybe than their parents have. And then, you know, the last bit is, are they moving out to other neighborhoods? And are we seeing kind of you know, the racial ethnic integration of neighborhoods, you know, often in the suburbs, right? Most immigrants today now live in the suburbs, which is, you know, not something that's not well known, right? And so to a certain degree, you know, I know we've got urbanists here. I mean, myself, I live in the city of Milwaukee, but I think the suburbs are really where a lot of this kind of, you know, integration, assimilation is happening. Essentially, people of similar socioeconomic status, not always, not all suburbs are the same, but people of similar socioeconomic status, but, you know, diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds can live together and see each other, right, as members of, you know, the same community. And I do think there's something important to that. For, if nothing else, to, you know, kind of soften the resistance to immigration that you see among some segments of American society. So that's how I weigh in on immigration, and I see it. And I'll just maybe add one more point that I think it's been very successful assimilation in the United States. You see this in terms of those socioeconomic gains, but you also see it in, you know, the integration of our neighborhoods, right? I mean, there is still a degree of segregation, but over time, our neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods as well, are integrating. I think that's a really, really positive sign.
I'm curious your thoughts as to migration as a policy and economic strategy and sort of how it's been instrumentalized. The obvious example that comes to mind was former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, who at one point called for 50,000 visas that, like, at his personal discretion, almost a hybrid Canadian model where the provinces here, for listeners, where the individual provinces have their own priorities in terms of what kind of economic migrants they want to attract, and they can sort of choose from there. But Snyder was going to do this as part of a revitalization of Detroit at its real sort of economic nadir there around the bankruptcy in the early 2010s. And yeah, we've seen other communities, other economic entities have sort of instrumentalized it as well. I remember Nick Redding's book, Methland, from 20 years ago, writing about, like, a lot of the Hispanics who are imported to run meatpacking plants and other things there. And there's plenty of smaller towns across the Midwest that have seen a lot of Hispanic migrants of types. What are your thoughts on this and the notion of, you know, should we be trying to actively repopulate Midwest cities? One of our past guests on Unfrozen was Alan Mollick, you know, writing about legacy cities. And he was, you know, advocating that, yeah, these are not failures to have shrinking cities. Like, they're just abandoning this gospel of ever-present growth. So I'm curious your thoughts on this sort of push-pull, right? It seems like, you know, half the time there's this, I don't know, I mean, American migration policy is a whole thing, but I do think it was interesting that you see in the Midwest this idea of, like, well, we need to import people, so let's figure out the strategies for doing so. How would you rate those efforts or those impulses?
Well, I share those impulses to attract more immigrants to the region. I mean, that is really the argument I'm making in the book. I suggest a model that is really based on that Canadian provincial nominee program. Right. And so, you know, under these types of what I call place-based immigration strategies or immigration policies, you know, there's different versions of it. Some work at the state level or some work at the county level, where let's just pick the state level. You know, the federal government would create a pool of work visas, work-based visas, and states could opt into that pool of visas to get a share of those visas, and then they could kind of structure you know, the types of skills that they're looking for among the immigrant population. Often, you know, with the provincial nominee program, the Canadian provinces will do is they'll select, you know, students that have gone to Canadian universities and, you know, give them, offer them an employment visa. And so, you know, this is a strategy to attract people, immigrants of various skill levels to regions that just haven't in the really, frankly, last 60 years or so seen, you know, really substantial, significant immigration, particularly when it comes to skill-based immigration. I should point out that, you know, I think it's important to point out with these types of programs that this is different from an H-1B employment-based visa. It doesn't tie workers to employers. It just ties workers to a particular region. You know, they can also, it's not, they're not just like loan temporary workers either. They have typically a path to permanent residency. They're allowed to bring their, you know, their spouse and dependents. And so it's, you know, I think it's a really a good revitalization strategy. And we've seen this in Canada. It was designed in Canada to get immigrants to go to places that were not the traditional, you know, immigrant hubs, you know, in Toronto or, you know, Montreal or in Vancouver.
Although, all right, so this is where, as a Canadian resident at the moment, an economic migrant myself, I want to push back on this or challenge you on where the biggest obstacles this are, because yes, the, you know, that vaunted point system, which is, you know, so many books have praised it, but under the Trudeau government, they rapidly accelerated immigration without any real programs to accelerate home building or, you know, sort of productive integration into that. And now Canada has a massive backlash against immigration. Population has fallen. And yeah, there's this political compact that's been broken. I'm curious your thoughts on, like, yeah, the ability of the Midwest to productively absorb more immigrants at this point, and particularly with regards to housing, because I was just literally giving a talk on this, noting that, like, yeah, the Midwest, after its depopulation wave during the pandemic, that whole push south, now, like, basically housing inventory is down like 44%, like, over the last 3 or 4 years in states like Wisconsin or Illinois. Like, homeowners are sitting tight, enjoying their nominal house price increases. And yeah, and the state is, like, outside of Columbus and Indianapolis, Carmel, and a couple other hotspots, it's sort of like frozen in terms of housing inventory. So yeah, even if we brought the people in and advanced that, you know, is there an appetite to, like, to build, to incorporate them? And this is where I feel like it gets back into some of the cultural politics too, about, does the Midwest even want to be great again, to use that rhetoric?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've been following what's been happening in Canada, right? And from what I gather there, right, Canada also saw kind of an influx of asylum seekers during the same period that we did here in the United States. And the Trudeau government initially, you know, I think prior to that, had proposed allowing in many more temporary migrants. And there was a backlash, like you said. And I just saw that Canada's overall population has declined over the last
year, which is insane. Yeah, absolutely insane. We should be absorbing so many more people into it. But yeah, it was seen as unskilled labor. The tropes here in the Canadian media are like burger flippers, you know, from South Asia. It would be the pretty much derogatory take on this. And so yeah, they feel like they've gotten away from their, how do we attract elite skilled labor? And I imagine maybe a similar pushback in the States too. This notion, if you're not, and even if you were importing doctors, you know, again, could you productively deploy them?
Yeah.
But yeah, how do you avoid that political trap in the Midwest?
Yeah. I mean, this is why I talk about, or write about in my book, assimilation, because I do think it is, you know, I'm very sympathetic to asylum seekers, and, you know, the conditions they're coming from, many of whom are, you know, could be categorized as economic migrants as well, but often of lower skills. And I think there is, maybe sadly, right, a limit to what people will accept when it comes to immigrants that they see as kind of charity cases. And so this is why I think, you know, like something like the provincial nominee program or a state-based visa program that is prioritizing, you know, different skill levels, higher skill levels. And maybe those are construction workers, right, that can work in the housing industry. Because, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this issue of housing is, it is the issue in many ways. I mean, you know, just it was interesting in my research looking at kind of I was really curious what drove the baby boom, right? Because I'm quite interested in kind of these declines in fertility, right? And the fact that we're not seeing that much kind of natural population growth, right? But then we had this, you know, there were those concerns in the 1920s and 1930s, and then all of a sudden this baby boom broke out, you know? So what were the forces driving the baby boom? And it was, from what I gather, a lot of it was just massive federal spending to build out housing. I mean, the housing, you know, single family housing in the suburbs, right, just ramped up to an incredible level, you know, just as World War II was coming to a close. And so this created this, you know, all these, you know, relatively affordable homes In the suburbs, it was very exclusionary, right? There was a lot of policies that kept racial minorities out of it, and that left all kinds of consequences, legacies from that. But it allowed for this population to move out to the suburbs, have larger homes, have a yard, right? And you see just kind of the fertility, you know, just increased so much during that period. Right. And just like the movement of Midwesterners down to the Sun Belt. Right. I mean, this was a lot of it was driven by relatively inexpensive housing. And so we're at this situation right now. We're just, you know, we're not building enough homes and people aren't moving because, you know, interest rates are high. And so, you know, and thinking about, you know, what the future holds, how this is all going to get sorted out. I just feel like we're in this holding pattern while interest rates in particular are higher. Right. I mean, I think, you know, maybe we'll have a discussion about whether the Midwest can be, you know, this kind of climate haven and whether that change is already happening. But I feel like we're just in this, you know, we're not going to see a lot of change until people feel like they can move.
Thank you, Jonathan. I spend a lot of time speaking to real estate audiences. And so even here in my podcast hobby, all we do is end up talking about interest rates, like really the arch lever of everything. But I do want to go to the smaller towns in the Midwest first, because, you know, there's so many main streets. And we see this as a trend across much of the global north here of like Spain, for example, massive depopulation of its rural areas. Entire villages are now being put up for sale. I mean, there's that whole plan, too, to repopulate, buy a house for a dollar, buy a village for a dollar. What should be the productive capacity of the smaller towns in the Midwest? Because, yeah, we have again seen Hispanic migrants in particular to go to some of these smaller places. But that economic geography is difficult to say the least. I mean, it's, again, like meatpacking and large-scale agribusiness, maybe a little bit of remote work in some of the more charming towns. But is there a strategy for those towns too? Or should we give up on those? That the economic geography of the Midwest has changed and we should be focusing on its core cities?
Yeah. It's kind of, I see it, right? I hate to say it, but, you know, there are many small towns that will continue to kind of peter out. They don't have, you know, that much of a productive base. You know, the people that are the children and these families are smaller now with lower fertility rates, right? They're often moving to nearby cities, right? And so I don't see it as, you know, just being like the big, you know, big cities of the industrial heartland, right? But other small, maybe medium-sized cities, I think, you know, can really thrive under a future of, you know, whether it's climate migration, domestic migration, or whether it's international migration, can thrive from that. But I do think, you know, I think, frankly, it's inevitable that we are going to see, you know, a lot of these much smaller towns, you know, kind of continue to contract, and you're going to see less services in those towns. You know, you're already seeing hospitals closing in some of these places. A lot of the services that are going to be needed to support an aging population aren't there. You know, obviously, you've seen this in Japan. You know, there's abandoning certain regions of the country because there's just, you know, it doesn't make sense to, you know, to continue to subsidize the existence of some of these communities. And so, you know, I think that is going to be the trend. And it has been the trend, you know, for so long, right? I mean, the metros have been, you know, the growth hubs, right? And this is all where just about all the growth is. And you see it now that in non-metro counties, most of them are in population decline. This isn't just in the Midwest. This is, you know, nationwide. And so, you know, I kind of think that trend is going to continue.
All right, let's dive into the climate question here too. So yes, our past guest, Jesse Keenan, you know, go down in infamy for jokingly coining climate-proof Duluth. And Jesse and I were roasted in The Guardian on a piece on like, there are no climate havens. But Jesse in his book, North, which we've had again in the past on Frozen, still talks about receiving regions. That there's going to be areas that will receive migrants of this. And one would think, I know I'm on the record about like Michigan, for example, and I still think like the west coast of Michigan is, you know, Grand Rapids, and there's incredible areas that could absorb more population. What's your prognosis there on this? You know, again, I imagine we would see resistance. I imagine we will see all sorts of political dynamics play out there. But like, yeah, is the future of the upper Midwest, particularly in the Great Lakes Basin, as the largest freshwater lake system on the planet, one that might maybe not thrive, given what we'll see in terms of destruction of overall productive, economic, and agricultural capacity due to climate change. But is that the is that a future for the Midwest? Is that the future for the Midwest?
I think it could be, yeah. And I mean, it could thrive productively, even in terms of agriculture. Right? I mean, if you look at some of those agricultural production maps, and they show, you know, increases in this area of particularly around the Great Lakes. You know, I do think that that is maybe our future here in the Midwest. You know, that the time frame that this happens is just, it's so hard to say, right? I mean, whether this is something that we're already starting to see, right? I mean, we've seen some of the, you know, domestic migration to the Midwest. It increased last year for the first time in decades, right? I mean, you saw places like Michigan go from, you know, seeing, you know, large numbers of out migrants, people moving out of the state. And now just within the last year, that's reversed, right? And we've seen a pretty significant increase both in Michigan and Ohio. Wisconsin's had, you know, we typically do fairly well in the Midwest, but we've had, I think, 4 years of positive net migration, right? And so I'm not exactly sure what's causing that. I'm very curious to know what people's motivations are for moving to the Midwest. I think often it is people that are from here that go elsewhere and then come back, right? I find it hard to believe, maybe this is Midwestern modesty, I find it hard to believe that people from other regions of the country out west or down south are, you know, thinking so much about climate change at this point that they're going to just, you know, pick up their families and move up here solely driven by climate change. I don't know that that's going to happen. Or it's not, I really don't think it's happening now. And I don't see a future where that is happening unless things get really, really dire. So I do think this is the future of the region. And just, you know, from personal matter, like I grew up in Wisconsin. I left for a while, moved out west, loved it out there, spent a little time in South America, moved back to Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular, did my PhD here and, you know, got a job. I've been a professor here for, you know, about 15 years now. And, you know, always thinking like, maybe I'll move out west. I really love it out there. And over time, and maybe this is having children now, but over time I'm thinking, you know what? I think I'm okay here. If I'm looking to the future, this is not a bad place to be.
I think it's extremely telling that Daryl Fairweather, the chief economist of Redfin, which is, of course, now owned by Rocket Companies, which is Dan Gilbert in Detroit, has bought up most of that. That Daryl literally moved from the Northwest because the real estate tech companies seem to be concentrated there, Zillow and others, to, I believe, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Oh, no kidding.
And will tell you that she thought long and hard about climate to that regard, too. And so, yeah, there are very smart people who are making these bets right now.
You know, Redfin, interesting. So their surveys, I've been looking at different surveys, just kind of been preparing for this conversation. And, you know, Redfin really, I'm not sure exactly how they're asking their questions, but I think it was among people that are planning on moving within the next year, you know, that climate was at the top of the list. You know, the National Association of Realtors has very different survey results where they don't even have climate as a question from what I saw. And it was like weather was one of the factors, whether that's, you know, weather is driving people to move, and it was just a small percentage, and it was all people that were going to the South, right? There was, I think, maybe 2% that said, you know, that they were moving to the places like the Midwest because of our wonderful climate here. All right. I'm always kind of wondering, you know, is this just a sliver of the population that are making these decisions based on climate or is it something larger? But ultimately, I think it comes back to housing and the cost of housing. And so I think that's the real determining factor still.
Well, it does seem unlikely we're going to solve the housing crisis anytime soon. But if you could sketch out a sort of desire line from the perspective of where you think there's, you know, demand from potential migrants to the U.S. if anyone still wants to do that, considering how hostile we've been over the past couple of years, And most importantly, what the gravitational factors are. Where are the greatest, most acute needs? Who would be filling the roles, and where would they be filling them in general? So, yeah. You know, is it doctors in Buffalo? Is it, you know, construction workers in Milwaukee? Like, what's the demographic that you could see being filled by migrants who are ready to come now? And that if we made a slight policy tweak, we might see some real change.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I've got a whole chapter dedicated to kind of labor shortages in the Midwest, and they're varied. I mean, there's labor shortages, kind of baked in structural labor shortages in a variety of industries. You know, the Midwest is still quite reliant on manufacturing as part of its economic base. And this is something that I've been really interested in for a while, because, you know, I've been hearing claims from employers for probably a couple of decades now, right, that they can't find workers with the requisite skills to do manufacturing work today. Right, and I've always been kind of dubious of those claims, and I frankly think it has a lot to do with kind of cultural changes here in the Midwest, where, you know, the younger generation is less likely to want to work in manufacturing, and that shouldn't be a real surprise. I mean, the buildup of the multicultural industrial heartland was really about immigrants coming in to work in manufacturing, and so I see manufacturing as an area where. You know, we could recruit immigrants to work in many of those industries, because it is really, you know, big contributor to our economic base. Obviously, a lot needs to be sorted out in terms of agriculture, and whether that's going to happen through, you know, a state-based visa program or just changes to the way in which we do, you know, more agricultural visas. That's another issue. Healthcare, right? Healthcare is an area where we need so many workers. I mean, I think we know that, right? The healthcare is really what's driving any employment growth, to the extent that we see any employment growth in the country right now. It's largely driven by healthcare. We've got an aging baby boomer population, right? And so we're going to need healthcare workers at a variety of levels, whether it's doctors, nurse practitioners, you know, personal care assistants, home aides, right? I mean, there's just so many jobs that are created in those types of categories as well. And then, you know, construction. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we need construction workers, and whether it's home building, right, or whether it's you know, more commercial real estate construction, building out infrastructure, right? I mean, we are just getting like a real low return on investment, I think, in a lot of our you know, construction infrastructure build outs, and a lot of that, I think, has to do with a labor shortage, right? So you can imagine a policy that kind of structures people, you know, potential immigrants based on their skills. Often these work where an employer will, or, you know, a prospective immigrant would have a job offer, actually, and that would up their possibility to get one of these employment-based visas, right? And so you could see maybe employers in the area, you know, talking about having these conversations, productive conversations, maybe with the state about what industries are demanding of the most jobs, right? And then we could provide visas for those workers. So it really is a, you know, a real range of industries where we've got that labor demand.
And it does still seem like the biggest issue is where to put people if they do show up, in terms of the building the housing, which we still can't seem to figure out how to do even for our shrinking population. So that's perhaps another question to tackle for another podcast. But Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been episode 118 of Unfrozen, Migrant Midwest, the Case for Immigration and Economic Growth in the American Heartland. Jonathan Mann Burkham has been our guest today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you both. It's been a real pleasure.
Sweet land of liberty, of the I see. Of the I see.